Welcome to the Hagman Report. It is Tuesday, the third day of February 2025. I want to welcome everyone to tonight's program. John Moore should be coming up, but before he does arrive, a couple of things. I want to speak on this because we have, let me pull something up here. Man, what's happening in America today, what's going on right now is really difficult to really comprehend. A lot of people are not understanding what's really taking place in America today. This is the continuation of a coup, of an internal coup that really began under Obama, that advanced as President Trump, it advanced in the attack against President Trump when he announced his presidency in 20, when he announced that he was running for president back in the middle of the teens. And the Russiagate hoax, all of that was crafted by the very same people who are running these operations right now, who are running these protests, which are, they're not protests. This is an organized revolution, if you will. This is something that we have, we cannot be allowed to, this cannot be downplayed at all. The individuals involved, and I did send a column to Wisconsin Christian News this last week. And in that column, I pointed a few things out. I admitted publicly, and I've done on admitted publicly here, that we have a presence inside, not the signal chat groups, but inside the forums, the password protected forums, the groups and subgroups that exist online. Now, the signal chat, for example, is something that is the mode of operation. It's an operational thing used by the grunts. All right. What I'm talking about are the operational commands, the people who respond to the commands. So we infiltrated, and successfully so, using a false name, a false identity with a legend. And this is important for people to understand. Following the attacks of 9/11, we were approved by the FBI, and I know I've said this before, but I want for the new people, for the people hearing this for the first time, just to explain the process. And as I mentioned previously, myself worked as an operational asset for the FBI and for the Department of Justice back in the mid 1990s. So just hold on, okay, before you start throwing things at me and at the whatever you're watching this on or listening to this on. And I established a relationship with some really good people at that time in the FBI, the old FBI. Now, one can argue, especially during that decade, there were a lot of problems, you know, Waco, and look, I get that. Okay, I totally understand. Ruby Ridge, Waco, and all of that. And the Murrah building. That began really a lot of the modern day practices of the FBI. Now, prior to that, were they into some bad stuff? Yes, but was it systemic? I don't know. I would say, yeah, it was. But I was working within a system, and the system I was working within had some good people. And also with NYPD, had some great people there as well, the detectives at NYPD. But having said that, following 9/11, and this is what I was getting to, following 9/11, a group of investigators, credentialed investigators, myself and others, including Randy Taylor, who you all know, we were approved as operational and informational assets as we infiltrated and surveilled the different groups and what have you. We found well, let me back up here. I was distracted. I'm sorry. I was distracted by that. As we coalesced as a group of investigators following 9/11, we began submitting information to the FBI. Actionable intelligence about real-time threats, Islamic threats. And then, of course, you know the story. Everything kind of went sideways, okay? With Obama and with the change in the Department of Justice leadership under Obama. Now, there was a time period, of course, a questionable time period under Bush, as we all remember, about the FBI itself, okay, about the institutional trust. We have trust in that institution. Well, any doubt of not being able to trust that institution under Obama certainly was erased. Any doubt not being able to trust that that FBI and Department of Justice, even in previous administrations, was solidified with Obama. Okay. So again, this is an important backstory because people will say, well, I mean, people will make broad statements. Everybody's bad. The rank and file's bad. The Department of Justice, the FBI, the leadership on down is all bad. You know what? Today, maybe it is. Maybe the majority are. And I have to think, as I look at things, I have to think, you know what? Yeah, I mean, we're not seeing a lot of productivity coming from the Department of Justice. We're not seeing a lot of productivity or forward movement coming from the FBI. All right. So I said that just to let people know the infiltration that I've done and that we've done into these groups and subgroups, these coup plotters, was done with a persona that was set up actually with, for example, for myself, my persona was created by the FBI and the Department of Justice back in 2002 or 2001, the late portion to the middle portion of 2002. Meaning that if someone would look up or identify that persona, online persona with me or with a name, not with me, but with a name, with the name associated with that online persona and the email address and other sets, they would find a person, a totally fictitious person, as opposed to it pointing back to me. Wow. I know. I struggled to get that out, right? But it was important for everyone to understand. So when things began to happen, and again, backstory, important context, important. So when things began to happen in absolute chaos in Minneapolis and elsewhere, under the presidency of President Trump and under the Patel leadership of the FBI, we reached out again and essentially reactivated everything that was inactive. That's the easiest way to say it. Otherwise, I'll be here all night because there's a lot of hoops we had to jump through and a lot of steps to go through that you don't see. So, all right. So all of that said, and let me pull this up here. Eric's in tech. You can tap dance if you'd like. Just to spend some time here. Hold on just one second here. Because I do want to bring this up for my reference, so I'm not all over the map here. And it's important because of what I'm going to tell you. Following the fatal shooting of Renee Nicole Good by ICE, by federal ICE agents, on January 7th, I was able to get into these groups that exist online. As a matter of fact, some are some reside on servers owned by and managed and maintained by the state of Wisconsin, or I'm sorry, the state of Minnesota. I was thinking of Wisconsin Christian News, which will outline the details of this. Now think about that. You have a state servers. You've got state websites. I'll just give you an example. For example, the state DMV website. Okay. On the back of that or behind that resides, not, this is an example. This is not specific to DMV. But on the back side of that exists what? Exists a group of individuals who are using the state server to communicate and to set up operational commands to the signal chat groups. You follow me? Am I making sense? So I was able to get into those groups using that false persona that was established with the assistance of the FBI and Department of Justice back in what, how many years ago? To be clear, these are not online forums and not mainstream messaging apps. So these are lesser known and more tightly controlled online sites where very specific higher level operational details are shared, and they contain detailed instructions, coordination plans, and directives written and posted by the individuals who control, instruct, and support the street level rioters, the street level attackers, the people that you see in all the videos. Here's what I found real quick. I see that John Moore just popped on, which is good because I want to talk to him about this. Everyone says these people are not, obviously, nothing that's happening is organic. Correct. It's all coming through various politicians and people in power. Here's what really stunned me. And these instructional commands picked up after the January 7th shooting of Good. What I found when I traced back who some of these members of these subgroups and forums were, I found two employees inside the office of the Hennepin County District Attorney's Office who are actively telling people to break the law. I found people driven by a strong and deep ideological belief in communism and Islam, a relationship that right now is at present anyway, a peaceful coexistence with the shared objective of the destruction of our nation by any means, including and especially violence. So two members of the Hennepin County District Attorney's Office. I also found an active line of support originating from the Office of the Attorney General of Minnesota, currently led by Keith Ellison, who, by the way, appears to be sympathetic to both communism and Islam causes. And then I found this. My findings suggested this. The current support for anti-ICE activities within the Minneapolis Police Department led directly to the current chief of police, Brian O'Hare. And his wife, as many people may not know, I don't even know how to pronounce her first name. Waffles? Waffle, yeah? I don't know. Waffles. I'll call her Waffles. Waffles O'Hara. Do you know that she's currently a lieutenant in the New Jersey Police Department? And she's recognized as the highest ranking black and Muslim woman in that department. In tandem with local law enforcement, and in tandem with the operational support and cover traced back to Hennepin County District Attorney Mary Moriarty, found that Moriarty was elected back in 2022 with the help of over $500,000 in campaign contributions from entities, including entities linked to George Soros. All right, we knew that. And she's the first openly homosexual district attorney in Hennepin County. And she's also an activist for LGBT causes. And in that capacity, she pledged not to prosecute anyone seeking, for example, reproductive care in Minnesota. Meaning, if you want to kill your unborn child, go for it. Right up through birth, go for it. And that's the current DA. And if anyone happens to be if there's another state looking to extradite someone under that crime, Moriarty said, "We will not honor any extradition or subpoenas from any other states pursuing such cases." Now, again, you might think, well, what does this have to do with the stuff going on? It has a lot to do. Just very briefly, and then I'm going to bring John on because, John, you were late, so shame. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, look, I also, in conjunction with the penetration into these forums and platforms, I trace him back, of course. First of all, you know Keith Ellison as the AG, current AG of Minnesota. But he was also the U.S. member of the U.S. House back between 2007 and 2019. And he was chair of the DNC from 2017 to 2019, concurrent with his House membership. Now, his pro-communism ideology can be traced back to the 1980s. And when he was at the University of Minnesota Law School, back in the late 1980s, Ellison was involved with the Black Law Student Association, which is the ideological predecessor of modern day Antifa. And he was arrested in 1988 for vandalism, spray painting some stuff, and in general being a dipshit. But he's also tied in with a guy by the name of Mark Bray. Everyone know who Mark Bray is? Mark Bray is the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. One last thing, and then John Moore, the Liberty Man, will be coming on. In that surveillance, which occurred right through and beyond the Preddy shooting, found direct evidence that employees working within the office of Governor Tim Walz and Lieutenant Governor Janet Flanagan were active in these, in providing operational instructions and support and cover for the people on the street. Both Walz and Flanagan have been supporting the Dar El Farouk Center, which is directly associated with ISIS. That group, or that association with ISIS, is also represented by the diaspora, by the Somali diaspora in Minneapolis, greater the Twin Cities. Hope Walz, the daughter of Tim Walz, you know her from her social media, appears to have an active presence under a fictitious name. on various forms, initiating operations directly against federal ICE agents. All federal agents, including ICE. Now, this very quick has a connection to Somali fraud. I won't get into it, but if you can imagine like a Venn diagram, simple Venn diagram, two circles overlapping in that center is the operational, or in the entire diagram is the operational instructions to harass, intimidate, and attack anyone, of course. But the inside that Venn diagram, of course, is the Somali fraud. So here's what you need to know, the takeaways from my surveillance operation. Here's what's being planned. ICE, well, I identified and submitted to the appropriate federal law enforcement agencies plans to target ICE and all federal law enforcement agents and operations. The tactics that they're talking about right now include ambushes, using a variety of weapons, from rocks and bricks to vehicles and firearms, from distances far away for escape. Think about that. Sniping operations in parking lots. Sniping operations at the places ICE is staying. Second on the targeting list, Christian churches, Jewish synagogues, all schools, public and private, with emphasis on private and Christian, and daycare centers. Ironic, isn't it? I guess real daycare centers. Homes and businesses of white Christian conservatives. Let me tell you something. Right now, there exists on these forums numerous lists of people they believe who reside in various neighborhoods all throughout the Twin Cities. And this has expanded to Portland, Los Angeles, New York, and elsewhere. If they think you are a white Christian who supported Trump, you are on a list that is published on state-held servers in the friggin' state of Minnesota. Now, I want you to understand that you're a target. Every single one of you, if you're white, if you're Christian, and if you support Trump, you're a friggin' target. And these bastards are, they're not only okay with this, they're supporting this. Blood is going to be shed. Short of someone stopping this, blood will be shed. And until somebody, let me tell you something. These checkpoints that they set up, it's my understanding some are coming down, but these checkpoints that are being set up, that doesn't work on my vehicle. I don't have a reverse, and I ain't too good at stopping. Just understand this, folks. This is a color revolution taking place where you and I are the targets. If you're listening to this, chances are you're a target, or you want to censor this and take this down. One of the two. The FBI has this information. The Department of Justice has this information. How do I know this? Because I gave it to them. So I guess we're going to see what happens. I'll let you know. I'll keep you posted. But this is a war. And I want you to understand how bad this is. I mean, this is a war. And please understand, do not think this is anything less than that. And this is pure, absolute pure evil. You've got no idea. No, you do. I don't mean to. I don't mean to despair. No, you do. But the extent, I'll tell you what, Walls, Flanagan, Allison, Omar, they need to be arrested. Pam? Cash? Anyone there? With me is John Moore to class up the place a bit. kind of a chunky, slow start on my part. I apologize for that, but I had a lot on my mind. I was trying to really frame that without giving too much, but giving enough, because I don't want, look, the worst thing for a surveillance operation is you don't want to compromise, right? So, all right. With John Moore, thelibertyman.com. He's got a show that can be heard every single day. Just go to thelibertyman.com and tune into his show. Follow the links. And I'm going to tell you something. If you're not doing that right now, if you're not listening to John Moore every single day, every weekday, you're missing out on some great information. That is thelibertyman.com. Go there. Read his news. Read the news that's on his website. Look at the personal stuff, too. Look at his background. The guy's been a homicide investigator, which, hey, resonates with me. Because, well, you know why. There it is right there on your screen. TheLibertyMan.com. John, thank you so much for being patient with me. Thanks for coming on, and God bless you. It's good to see you, my friend. It's been too long. How are you?
Fantastic. Well, I had a teenage daughter. That makes me very patient.
believe me. Yeah.
Good to be with you. You conducted a surveillance in up in Minneapolis area?
Yeah, it was online surveillance.
Online.
Yeah,
okay,
online. Gotcha. However, yes, right. but not of the signal track groups, John. And it was gotcha. through static forums that are being hosted by state-owned.
Well, there's
server, Scott.
There's a law that I know back in the it would have been the early to mid 70s that was being enforced when people crossed state lines to impede federal law enforcement from doing their job. They were arrested as soon as they crossed the state line, because that was a crime in and of itself. And it happened many times, and I haven't heard that happening here with what's going on in Minneapolis. But please recall the Ferguson riots. Of course, St. Louis, Metro St. Louis is my hometown. The local newspaper, which is quite liberal and communist, they started publishing the home cities and states of the people being arrested. Out of every 100, about 3 were Missourians. The rest were from out of state. In fact, within 3 hours of Michael Brown being shot up in Ferguson, convoys were on the way from Detroit. Now, the 82nd Airborne can't mobilize that quickly. It takes them 24 hours to get their kit ready to go to fight a war. But these convoys of riders were on the road within 3 hours to come to St. Louis for that event. With the arrests that have been made, feds should, obviously, they confiscate the telephones of the people being arrested, which is a treasure trove of intelligence to see who's connected to who and how they're connected. And I hope there's a lot of investigations going on, these people being arrested, to determine who they are, who they're connected to. And there should be charges filed if they cross state lines to impede officers in carrying out their duties, which is a clear violation of federal law. And I haven't heard that happening. Have you, Doug?
No, I haven't, John. And I'll tell you this. I'm concerned, period, that we're not getting any kind of effective investigation or even attempts to compile evidence for prosecution at this point. Because, look, I know what I've turned over, okay? And there's sufficient evidence for any agent, any investigator of the federal government, and pick your departments. There's ample evidence of interstate and even, I'll say, international funding on the international side.
Right.
But interstate transport, crossing state lines, as you stated, ample evidence. But I'm not sure we're going to see anything. Are you hopeful, or what is
what should be happening is the Minnesota State Patrol should be forming a perimeter before the ICE even shows up, so that ICE can show up and peacefully do what they need to do to arrest these criminal, these illegal aliens, and the protesters can't get close enough to cause any problems. That's what should be happening, but it's not. It's not happening, obviously.
No. And, you know, you mentioned Ferguson, and you mentioned, or maybe you didn't, but the Rodney King riots, but you know, that has shown us.
Well, let me tell you about Rodney King. I've interviewed two people. One was a retired Los Angeles County firefighter. He left after the Rodney King riots. He says, John, after the riots were over, after the buildings were burned down, we were recovering military issue pyrotechnic devices from the burned down buildings. So these were not organic riots of people upset that Rodney King was beat up. If you're a black resident in the ghetto, you simply can't get your hands on military issue pyrotechnic devices. You simply can't do that. There was a lot more behind us than we know publicly.
Amen to that. And the Rodney King riots were a response prior to the Rodney King issue in Los Angeles. There was the Latasha Harlins case, and that was the a police shooting fatally shooting a 15-year-old black teenager by the name of Latasha Harlins, and that happened on March 16th of 1991, South Central LA. It's just so people understand this, and that caused some outrage. This 15-year-old walked into a liquor store at about 10 in the morning, and she went to buy a bottle of orange juice, apparently. And, well, she put the bottle in her backpack and handed $2 to, she had $2 in her hand. And you know what? I'm not going to go through the whole thing because it's just, no matter what I would say, it would be misrepresented. But that began a certain series of events that led to the Rodney King, that led to and built from that. It built upon the Rodney King, of course, what happened in Ferguson. And John, you know, here we are. We have given them, that side, enough time to refine. You're saying about military issued devices. We have given them enough time and enough space to refine their tactics and to recruit others and to have people in positions of authority like the chief of police, for example. And we've allowed this to happen, and now we are paying the price for this. Go ahead, sir. I mean, it's just hard for me to really comprehend what's taking place.
The communists have been at this since 1917 when they took over Russia. The Bolsheviks were never more than 3% of the Russian population. But their goal was to take over the world in 1917, and still is. And they've had great success in many areas. There was a federal law that prohibited Muslims from holding public office at the federal level. That was done away with in the early 1950s. We need to reinstitute that.
Yep.
We used to have loyalty oaths for all federal employees. That was done away with. That needs to be reinstituted. We need to cut off federal funding to any college, university that implements DEI, promotes Marxism, or promotes Islam. All federal funding needs to be cut off of all those institutions. DOGE has done a great job in apparently many of these NGOs were receiving U.S. tax dollars for their NGOs, and that money in turn was going to Marxists and Muslims. Most of that's been cut off, as far as I know. USAID was one of the big ones. I hope it's not too late. I really hope it's not too late. Marxists, I call our opposition socialists, communists, Democrats, Muslims. They're receiving money from other sources. There's a guy in China who's funding what's going on in Minneapolis. That needs to be cut off somehow, some way. The gloves need to be come off, quite frankly. They really do. Now, going back to Minneapolis, the fraud these fraudulent companies allegedly providing home health care, hospice care, transportation of patients. You know, at one time, Doug, the FBI only hired accountants and lawyers. They expanded that, but that kind of fraud taking place in Minneapolis, you need accountants and lawyers to figure out what the hell went down, who did it, and how they did it, don't you? Of course, California, the fraud in Minneapolis is as bad as several billion dollars. The fraud in California is going to triple or quadruple that easily.
California is going to put Minnesota to shame.
It will.
I'll just say that. Yeah,
it will. Absolutely, it will. And cutting off the money is critical to solving everything else. It is absolutely critical. And arresting and prosecuting people who have crossed state lines to impede the U.S. Law enforcement, ICE and others, from doing their duties, that needs to be dusted off and put into service, because there's a high likelihood, in my opinion, that many of the rioters in Minneapolis are not from the state of Minnesota. They're from other places.
There's a core group. What I found, just what I was looking at, you know, aside from whatever other media influencers or media, social media people, people like Cam Higby and others, aside from what they found, here's what I found, and here's what I can speak to with authority. There is a core group who live and have businesses or are in positions of influence, such as within the DA's office, within the police department, and mayor and governor and lieutenant governor. All those offices are representative, as well as Ilhan Omar's office is represented. So there is a core group that are pushing, and about that core group, and you said something, and I think, folks, you got to understand this too. There was a framework, a strategic framework that was established in Minnesota, laid out by these communists, okay, drawing from the color revolution tactics that were observed in Eastern Europe and beyond. This is back, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And people like Saul Alinsky, which we talk about Saul Alinsky.
Right.
Okay. So who remembers the late Senator Paul Wellstone? Well, Wellstone had created this progressive, that's what they called it, this really a communist Wellstone Action Group. And this is what I found to exist within these core, and folks, you maybe never heard of this, but this Wellstone Action Group, Saul Alinsky was really, they used Saul Alinsky's tactics to create this Wellstone Action Group. And lastly, Walls and his people, his administration, really illustrate the Alinsky's rules for radicals by scapegoating, for example, ICE and Republicans and President Trump and so on. And that's for two reasons, obviously. There's a heck of a lot of money involved in that scam stuff, but there's also other things going on too. The state fraud and public safety issues are one thing, but through all of this, they're creating a perception of power through deflection while staying within their progressive or within their communist policy advocacy, especially on immigration. And here's the last thing. Walls has connections, and this is so important. The political and operational training Walls has received, he transitioned from a career as a high school teacher and National Guard veteran into politics. But during that early political time, he, and even a little bit before that, one could point to, he was training with, he taught English and American history, by the way, in China, in Guangdong province, through World Teach, which was affiliated with Harvard nonprofit program, funded partly by the Rockefeller Foundation in its early years. So the reason I brought this up is because the tactics that are being used and pushed into the operational instructions, which I referenced, our Chinese, refined Chinese think, well, they're Chinese tactics, operational tactics. So I'm just saying that, John, you hit the nail on the head with that connection to China. So, but it's all kind of goes back to the mid 80s in that area of our country with walls. Go ahead, sir.
Well, it's funny you should mention Wellstone. I was scheduled to be on a nationwide talk show when Senator Wellstone's plane crashed. It was, I think it was on a Thursday, it was the 25th day of October 2010. And I got canceled because of they decided to cancel my appearance on that nationwide talk show. That was that. So, yeah, he was murdered.
Interesting.
No doubt in my mind. The FAA ruled it pilot error, but everything I saw told me it was murder.
Well, you know something, I don't doubt that, but Wellstone, I did not realize how deep into the community organizing he created a very powerful volunteer driven network through very low budget campaigns, mobilizing students and unions and farmers and activists. And, so the death that you're talking, his plane crash and his death, right after that, the leftist communist machinery, it kind of went away and then it came back. It did weaken the DFL party in Minnesota, but then it came back with a vengeance. And Wellstone's campaign manager, Jeff Blodgett, longtime campaign manager, in fact, he was known as the Yoda of Minnesota politics, played a very pivotal role in furthering Wellstone's activism, if you will. So it's very interesting what has happened. And the plane crash, I would ask who would target Wellstone, especially if he's the darling of the left. But that's, I don't know. I mean, I'm just curious.
We'll probably never know that.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think you're right. So, yeah. But okay, so I guess I took enough time on that. Unless you want to, what's on your mind? What are you looking at? What do you think is important?
There's some pretty, it's breaking news. The FBI found a biological weapons laboratory in Las Vegas. Connected to CPP, CCP, Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party are probably clever enough to not have most of these labs found. So they found one, was it 2 years ago or so? And another one today.
They found one in Los Angeles. I know that.
Right.
And then.
It's been a while back.
Yeah. You're right. 2 years ago. Yeah.
So the big question for me is how many have they not found?
Good point.
You know, and I've got the speech from the top Chinese general at my website 20 years ago, where he's advocating biological weapons being used against Americans, race specific, by the way, biological weapons used against Americans to kill off Americans and have 500 million Chinese come here to take over what we've built, New China. That's basically it. And I don't think that plan has changed at all.
I don't either. And John, if you can humor me, I guess, using your analytical mind as an investigator, and folks, John is a great, absolutely fantastic investigator. Homicide investigations, he did a lot of pre-trial work in his work. And I mean, our backgrounds, although frequently on opposite sides of the investigative column, nonetheless, I got to tell you, John is a great investigator and a very formidable foe in a courtroom. So I appreciate that about him, and I appreciate his attention to detail. So, by the way, I just, again, I want to make sure everyone knows he's got a radio show. Go to thelibertyman.com and make sure you listen to him, his guests and such. So, but using your analytical skills, to what extent do you think everything that we're seeing, including and especially the institutional compromise of DOJ, FBI, and again, insert name of institution here, is by the Communist Chinese Party? Or, I mean, can you?
Well, okay. This goes to the topic of countermeasures and counterintelligence. What we've seen publicly is honeypots, or a beautiful Chinese woman will seduce an American congressman, for example, which has happened. We know that. Was it Swalwell that has the Chinese
girl? Time. Fang, yeah. Fang, bang, bang. Let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's what we know publicly. Of course, a honeypot woman could be Nordic, not necessarily Chinese. And they have lots of ways to compromise elected and appointed officials by honeypots, by blackmail, by money, or a combination of two or more of the above. And never discount the ability of your enemy. That's always a mass mistake. They could be barefoot peasants in Vietnam. Don't discount them.
Exactly.
Barefoot peasants can be very clever and kill you. they may not have any sophisticated weapons, but they have ingenuity. They're determined, and the Chinese are very bright people. They have a higher IQ than Caucasians do, and they got deep resources. My friend Jeff Nyquist, who's my Thursday guest, he has a Chinese national that he interviews on a regular basis, Mr. I don't want to say his name and get it wrong, but it's at Jeff's website. You can read. They mentioned in passing 250,000 Chinese commandos in this country right now, trained, equipped, motivated, ready for orders to do the things that all commandos of all militaries do, which is blow things up and kill people.
Yep.
Now, there's a lot of discussion about President Trump and where his true loyalties lie, but on one hand, on the other, President Trump, followed by another 8 years of a similar guy, would set back the communist plan for decades, literally decades, and maybe forever. And that makes these people desperate. That makes the Communist Party in China desperate. And as the old saying goes, Tug, desperate people do desperate things. The goal of Chinese, as I said, is at my website, the speech by the top Chinese general, is to conquer the United States and have no Americans present. New China. That's the goal. And they'll do whatever it takes to achieve that. There's something called asymmetrical warfare, which has been fought now for more than a century. Cultural warfare, economic warfare, and of course, these proxy wars. Vietnam was a proxy war. You think Vietnamese pilots were flying the MiG jet fighters, and that Vietnamese mechanics were repairing the Russian MiG jet fighters? Hardly. as if those 1,000 paid manuals were written in Vietnamese. They were written in Russian. That's a different story. But we've had a proxy war now with Ukraine for, I think this is the fourth year now. We're into the fourth year of that war.
Yep. And man, you know, John, a lot of people really have failed to understand the backstory behind the Ukraine-Russia war and who really started that war. You know, you go back to really hostilities began in the current iteration back in 06, but really under Obama. And then, I mean, under Obama, it really ratcheted up. And then, of course, you had Maidan, what happened there and with that revolution. And of course, here we are today. So Yeah, talk to me about the status currently of Ukraine, Russia.
We being the West, pushed Russia to the point where they felt they had no choice. They tried to cover it up, but they finally, it leaked out publicly that Ukraine had about 40 biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine, working to develop Slavic specific weapons, biological weapons. Who would they be used against? Well, of course they'd be used against Russians. The Ukrainian government was murdering, attacking the ethnic Russians living in the eastern part of Ukraine.
Yes.
The treaty that was signed by all parties was, we now know publicly, was merely to buy time for Ukraine to prepare for the war. Russian honored that treaty, but it was just used to buy time to properly prepare Ukraine to fight Russia. And, of course, within 24 hours, Russia could have shut down every source of electricity in Ukraine if they chose to. They had the power to do that, and they still do. But they didn't. My feeling on that matter is what Russia is doing is allowing the West, all the NATO countries, to use up military resources that can't be quickly or easily or cheaply replaced, artillery shells and more armor, aircraft, and so forth. And that's what's happened. The NATO stocks of weapons to defend the West have been pretty much diminished and used up these past three years, including U.S. stocks, putting the NATO countries in a pickle, because it'll be known publicly, and Russia, if Russia wants to do something, they know the West cannot resist because they've used up and depleted all supplies. They know that. And if it's not public record, it will be public record very soon.
So it's a war of attrition is what's happening, a deliberate war of attrition. But it's also, in a way, it's serving to turn NATO into a nothing but a
paper tiger.
Yeah.
Same term. We use the same term at the same time, paper tiger. Yeah. And I think President Trump has had it with NATO. They've been relying on us to defend their borders now since into World War II, and not putting in their fair share of money or our men, either one. Now we've got NATO countries seeing that they're on the precipice of war, implementing drafts, putting factories in service to replenish the depleted supplies. Both of which take years to do. You can't just tanks don't just pop off the assembly line like toasters. It takes a while to manufacture these complex, expensive pieces of equipment that have been used up.
It's a great point, and you know, people have this working theory of how, I mean, the World War II stopped production. While that was a thing in World War II, a lot of that, the production has changed because of the complexity of the machinery and the it's not like it was. It's not like it was, which impacts, of course, the replenishment of weapons, as John said, and that's we're in a world of hurt there, but
we are,
man. One thing you mentioned, the bio labs in Ukraine. I do know, and this has been not just sourced but also verified, that the U.S. did have some bioweapon labs, specifically the U.S. Now, not in conjunction with, but in addition to other bioweapon labs in Ukraine, which is very interesting.
It's also a violation of international law.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. So there's that, folks. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, John.
Well, our listeners, I refer to myself as a barefoot peasant compared to what's going on in these geopolitical matters. We can't change them. We can observe them. We can watch them. But our listeners and our viewers need to pay heed, make sure their family can survive without electricity from the power grid, without food at the supermarket. It can defend life and property from whatever comes their way up the street. It may be criminals. It may be communist commandos. We simply don't know. So I always advise to get ready.
Yeah, exactly. No, you're right, because when I saw, when I saw these groups in Minneapolis specifically, because that was the focus of my online surveillance, when I saw them, when I saw the instructions of, okay, we're going to create a database of the names, the addresses, the vehicles owned, the locations of, or places of their employment of all white, and the categories, the broad category. Again, I don't want to give operational details out, right, because right. Obviously the surveillance continues, but they're after white Christian, Trump voting, working American patriots, right. And they're making a list, and they intend to attack them in Minneapolis, and it's happening elsewhere. So, John, I mean, you're right. We've got to understand the threat, and we also have to prepare for it. Go ahead.
The threat is very real. You know, the list is basically half the people, more than half the people in the country. So whoever's behind us should realize pretty quickly that they're outnumbered greatly by the Christian patriots, white Christian patriots. And we own firearms and we know how to use them. So they'll meet an untimely end if they try to implement their ideas of violence against white Christian Americans. I know in my neighborhood, they wouldn't last a day.
your neighborhood. I think you're being generous with that description. John lives like Moses. Like, John lives at the top of this mountain, okay? And the nearest sign of any civilization beyond wildlife would be like, you know, a 40-minute drive somewhere, right? I mean, that's...
It's not quite that remote, but it's close to it. But you'll see about 1 out of 10 homes still fly the stars and bars, the Confederate flag. It's not there for decoration. Right. And we had, during the George Floyd riots, there was a busload of rioters that traveled to two counties south. The sheriff knew they were coming. He was alerted by the highway patrol. He activated the county militia. Each of his 12 deputies was in charge of about 20 civilians armed with deer rifles and shotguns. And the rioters showed up, and they never got off the bus because they saw armed men and women on every corner. They went back to where they came from.
Oh man, that's the way. But that's the way. But see, how does one do that? You could be living in a red state, but a blue city, and you could be living in the suburbs, or you could be living in a mobile home park, or you could be living in an HOA subdivision somewhere. I'm telling you right now. Yeah,
here's what the sheriff did. He called the commander of the local American Legion. He called the commander of the VFW. He called the pastors of the big churches and said, assemble your people. We need to get ready. That's what he did. Probably 8 or 10 phone calls at the most.
But there was a type of infrastructure present, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. But it's a small town America. That's simply the way it is.
Okay. All right.
We all know each other. You know, you get to a small town, everybody went to the same high school. You know? When you have a high school reunion, everybody's there because everybody went to the same high school.
It's amazing. And that's the difference, of course, between that rural, and I'm not saying suburban, but a very rural community as opposed to, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, where you got, you know, vertical life there. Okay.
So I'll give you a personal example. Saturday, I was at the hardware store. They were 10 minutes from closing. They got a call from a customer and needed a heater. We got below zero weather. And the manager said, I'm about to close. I'll take the heater over to the supermarket, pay for it over the phone with a credit card. He delivered the heater to the supermarket about a half a mile away, and a customer went to the supermarket to pick it up.
That's how God intended it.
That's how small towns work. We take care of each other, you know?
And so they still exist in America today, folks. God bless that community and communities like that. And that's what we're going to need to survive what's coming.
I'll give you another example. My wife and I were going to visit my brother two counties over. It was a nice, warm day, a sunny day. And I was driving my old Dodge, which was my surveillance van for years, by the way, and it had a mechanical problem. So we're sitting in a restaurant. We're talking.
Wait, I can't let that go. Hold on a second, because I had a surveillance van, okay, as well. Now, it was, I had two, actually, a cargo van with a construction mark. It was a cargo van, construction car. It was made to look like a decoy type van, but inside it had all the electronics and stuff. Now, the other van, mine was a Dodge, whatever that brand was. But it was the commercial Dodge. I think it was a Caravan. Was that yours? Kind of like yours?
Well, this particular, I've had several, but this one was a 3/4 ton Dodge full size van with a 318. It gets better. Okay. It had a tow package, which made a lower gear rear end. I had Rancho shocks in all four corners. I had an anti sway bar mounted in the front. I had speed rated tires in all four corners, originally made for a Corvette, 12 inches wide, and about a 14 inch diameter steering wheel. You know what autocross racing is?
I do.
Okay. I took it to autocross racing.
Oh, my. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I smoked the tires the entire course and didn't knock over a single rubber cone.
Man.
Oh, yeah.
So you were okay, and you folks in if you've done surveillance, okay, especially mobile surveillance, you got to respect John's description. And
I'm not done.
Still my heart. Go ahead.
This is before the film came out, Air America. I had magnetic signs, red, white, and blue magnetic signs that said Air America. Air quality testing serving Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. And I had those, and I had a lab coat with a little patch on my breast that said Air America, and a little hat that said Air America on it. And I'd park right across from the subject's house and set up shop like I was testing the air.
We've got similar stories. Mine wasn't air testing, but it was construction, and I get the idea. So how great is that, though?
It was great until the movie came out.
Then you had to change signage and change pretext. But, oh, man.
For those who don't know, Air America was the CIA Air Force in Vietnam and Laos.
Virtually somewhat unknown until the movie. And then
it was pretty much unknown until the movie.
Yeah. So yeah, that movie cost you that cost you some bucks. Well,
a few bucks for some new magnetic signs, but not a big deal.
Wow. But that's you know what, folks, again, until you've been in the active surveillance operations,
my other cover story, okay. I had several, but being a nature photographer, I had business cards printed up. I had an Autobahn book, and I would park in somebody's yard about a mile from where I needed to be, and I would knock on the door. Have you seen this bird that's been spotted in this area? And they'd say, well, I'm not sure. Can I park my vehicle here while I go look for the bird? Oh, yeah, no problem. Would you want some coffee and a piece of pie? Oh, sure, I'll have coffee and a piece of pie. And then I'd spend the day out in the woods going to on my surveillance.
Yeah. See, and, you know, folks, I guess it's age, too, because that's before drone technology. That's that was made commercial. That's before the people that were working today are working with equipment that was unavailable to investigators unless you were with the CIA or FBI. But, well, even the FBI didn't have that stuff. But now, man. So you and I, we did things the hard way. We had to use ingenuity. Whereas today, technology supplants the ingenuity, but there you go.
Well, different times, different techniques, different equipment. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I remember my partner in a full telephone gear with the hard hat going up on a telephone pole, not to fix, but to... statute is passed by now, but to tap into a line. Okay. Telephone company truck. Actually, to be in one case, we actually paid a telephone operator, a telephone guy that went on a pulse. We paid him $50 for 15 minutes use of his van, went up the pole. We offered him more. We offered him like $100 to tap in the line. He said, oh, no. Okay, 50 for the van. Yeah, no problem. So the partner went up, had the hard hat, had the jacket with up the pole, and split into the subject's line. And yeah, we had a direct line to all of his phone conversations. But then again, I didn't do that. I'm just telling stories because
right,
I'm old.
Right.
I'm not sure if the statute's up on that, but yeah. Okay. So I'm old. I'm just telling stories. Okay. John, you and I, I'm telling you what. Yeah. But my goodness. It's fun times. But again,
there's nothing fun about surveillance. It's hard work.
Yeah. It's rough on your kidneys, your bladder.
I had a porta potty in my Dodge.
Oh, shut up. I had a mayonnaise jar. Okay. So, or we had to keep the cups, which folks, you don't want to mix up the cups.
Don't mix up the cups. No.
Bad thing. Yeah. And then you were, I did a lot of surveillance in New York City. Okay. And let me tell you, that's a whole different world, even back 20 years ago.
Oh, I bet.
30 years ago. All right. We should just reminisce. You know what? We should just spend an entire program reminiscing on what we did, because some people would not believe what we did or had to do just to get the goods.
The story's starting to come to the surface. Downtown St. Louis, no more than 10 blocks from the football stadium. Well, my partner and I were both Vietnam vets. We met on the parking lot of the Civic Center, the community center, before dusk. It was a 12-hour surveillance from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. So we meet about 6:30 or so. We both put on our Vietnam issue flak jackets. We check our weapons. We check our radios. He was half a block east. I was half a block west. And we get on our position. And about 8 or 9 o'clock, there was gunfire, not directed at us. And then maybe an hour or so later, automatic weapons fire. The police patrolled in two patrol cars with two officers each, one 10 feet behind the other. If they had to go to a call, one officer protected the two cars while other three responded. About middle of night, the sergeant was a black female police sergeant. She stopped by to talk to me. She said, I just had to find out who this white guy was in my neighborhood. And so I told her what I was doing. She said, be safe. And she went on a patrol. But in parts of St. Louis, there's automatic weapons fire all night, every night.
Yep.
It never makes the news, ever. This is 30 years ago.
Exactly. And
it's bad for business.
Of course it is. But again,
I got another story for you.
Please, yeah.
Okay. Surveillance, another 12-hour surveillance, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., a daytime surveillance. A major east-west street in St. Louis. And so I set up about 7 a.m., and things are going fine. About 8 o'clock, I notice a car pulls up behind me. A person goes to the door. They're there maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and they're gone. 10 or 15 minutes later, another person. 10 or 15 minutes later, another person. And obviously, it's a drug house. So I started writing down license plates, times, and descriptions. And I'm doing my surveillance also. 7 p.m., I'm done. This is before cell phones. I find the nearest payphone. I call up the watch commander for that precinct, that police precinct, identify myself, and I say, I got a case made for you, license plates, times, descriptions. Where should I bring it? Here's the response. Oh, John, we're too busy. Everybody's out looking for a guy with a knife that's hurting people. Now, the St. Louis City Police Department has more than 1,000 officers, and they couldn't find one officer to take the legal pad page that I had with a complete list of all these customers at the drug house.
Man, that pisses me off.
Well, I'll piss you off even more.
Okay.
I ran for Congress in the 1996 cycle. I'm knocking on doors in a neighborhood. It was real close to the Anheuser-Busch Mansion, which is a marvelous place. And it's a warm spring afternoon, and the homeowner is a retired DEA field agent. And I spent some time with him, about a half an hour talking. He says, John, every drug introduction operation I had for my entire 20-year career, once we got to the third level above the street dealer, we were shut down and reassigned. Everyone, without exception.
Really?
And I said, why is that? And he says, well, when you get to the fourth level above the street dealer, you start bumping into people connected to the government. That's why we were shut down every time for 20 years.
Okay.
The job of the DEA is to eliminate competition, not to enforce the law. It's to eliminate competition with the government.
Well, okay, so I'm glad you brought that up, because if you go back to Iran-Contra and the drugs, especially the drugs into MENA, Arkansas, and this is still, it's as far as I know, this process still exists today.
Of course it does.
Yeah, but this, okay, so the IC or the CIA will insert markers into some of the precursor chemicals that are being used by a certain cartel for, we'll just say, cocaine, just for the, so to make, or whatever it might be. So when a drug bust occurs, they could field test the cocaine and find the marker. And if it's if it doesn't have the marker of the genetic, or I guess it would be genetic or chemical marker for that batch of drugs, then that's the opposing cartel.
Right.
So they confiscate that stuff. The other stuff, they let go.
Well, another story. A very dear friend of mine, he served in the Mekong Delta with the Special Forces the same time I was there. We didn't know each other then. We became very good friends after Vietnam. But he's getting ready his tour is over. He's getting ready to leave. And one of the guys on his Special Forces A team hands him a brown paper sack full of $100 bills. And he says, what's this for? And the team member says, Bob, what do you think we made all those trips to Cambodia for anyway?
Sad but true, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the dope was being brought back in coffins and went to Dover, Delaware, Dover Air Force Base, where it was unloaded. And that's what they did.
That's, yeah. And folks, John, I think they made movies about that, or at least one, if not more movies about that. But documentaries, look, it's to think that this country, what they did and are doing still, you know, with drugs. I do want to share this with you, because I guess this could be my final story. I had a case where, if anyone is familiar with New York City, if you've been to if you've ever been to Brownsville, okay, which is known, it's Brooklyn, Brownsville, whatever. It's actually the most, it has been the most dangerous area in New York on the map, on the planet, basically. But it's always high in homicides and always high in violent crime and all that. So I had a case there, and I had a van. I had a cargo van, and that was parked on one of the streets there. Of course, it's all tenements, high rises, and multifamily dwellings and such. So as I'm doing surveillance, again, folks, you have to understand, this looks like a van that would have tools in it. and you know, really no windows. So, you know, you park it and you kind of slide back into the back and you, you conduct. So I'm doing surveillance there. And it was, I think I got there. It was before dawn that I got there. So there wasn't much activity. I was able to secure a nice space. And it was like around 8 a.m. I hear this, this noise, a scraping on the back. And I was like, what the hell's going on? So, I was able to see out the sides and out the front through pre-positioned cameras. Anyway, all of a sudden the back doors fly open.
Of course. Yeah. I know what's coming. Go ahead.
And there's like three, black dudes. And they were expecting to rip off some tools, and they see all this equipment. And honest to God, their eyes got like, you know, all you could see was white. And I'm thinking, look, I don't have a weapon.
Oh no.
Okay, but I do. Well, I've, you know, to the best of everyone's knowledge, I had no weapon. But anyway,
I wouldn't be there without a pistol. But go ahead.
Anyway, because in New York, it's 5 years. Even if you are a credentialed investigator, that's fine. So they took off and I shut everything back up and it was cool. Like an hour and a half later, I hear the same and the doors fly open again. And here's two other guys. I'm thinking, what the hell? You know? So again, we go through the same process again and they go, poof. So I just shut the doors. That happened two more times. Okay. Before
in the same location.
Same. I didn't move. I didn't turn a tire. And so, but their reaction was priceless because, man, they were not expecting that. But I'll tell you what. Okay. I don't know what would happen today because.
Well, I got a follow up on that.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm on surveillance in a small town in Southern Illinois. It's a warm day, not hot, but warm. And I had the driver's window and a passenger window down. And with my curtains, I could see 360 degrees. And I see this guy walking down the street, in the street. And he's walking up on the driver's side. And I see him slow down next to the driver's side, and he reaches in to see if there's a key in ignition, and I smack his hand with a fly swatter. He took off.
It was pretty
funny.
You know, on a separate day, I got to say the same thing. Somebody tried to get in the front driver's side of the same vehicle, by the way, which not in that location at the time. And so I was able to scare off that person the same way. Not with a fly swatter, actually it was a metal rod that was using to, I had used to prop something up at the time. But anyway, scared the living crap out of that person. So
I bet.
Good for them. And the fly swatter is.
It was perfect. It worked out really good. Yeah.
I can see that, man. Such is the life of surveillance. And
I didn't say a word. I didn't yell real quiet. Just smacked his hand.
You don't need to, man. An unexpected swat with a fly swatter, that'll do it every time. Oh my goodness, wrong vehicle. Yeah, or what the hell was that? Yeah, and but you know when you do these surveillances, John, and I know you sit there for, you know, 12-hour shifts or 15-hour shifts, and man, you know, wow, and yeah.
Well, all you can, you know, listen to talk radio and watch what I got to watch. That's basically it.
Yeah, yep. And I'll tell you, but now think about this now with everyone that has Ring doorbell cameras and surveillance cameras. It's a whole different environment, which I'm just saying you're always on camera. And now, you know, before, I mean, I remember when you paid with actual cash for tolls, right? There were toll booths, the guy in the toll booth. Now, you know, hey, you go over I-4 in Florida, for example, your license plate readers, you can't get away with crap today. Or unless you're leftist, Democrat, communist, then you can. Or Muslim, then you can. Somali, you know, just.
For a while. It's going to catch up with them. It's in the process of doing so.
Man. John Moore, thelibertyman.com. That's his website. And I'll tell you what, he's got a great radio show. Listen to that. Plug into that every single day of the week. John, I'm looking at your, man, you've, I looked at it, the reason I'm stalling here. No, I'm not on drugs. Okay. No, I was looking at some old photographs. And I had some old photographs from some surveillance stuff that we did. Okay. And I must have, I mean, I was a fat pig. Okay. Because you sit in the back of a van and you eat nothing but, you know, cold pizza, drink stale coffee, maybe a Mountain Dew here or there. And you're sitting there for, and you're killing yourself, right? Chain smoke and in my case or whatever. And it, let me tell you what, you know, it catches up with you. I'll tell you, but, John, you've always looked great. I don't know how you kept that.
Well, my recently deceased wife, Dr. Moore, was a chiropractor, and she made sure I ate healthy food, so that was a big help. And I never smoked, and I stopped drinking soft drinks. So
yeah.
But I drank a quart of coffee before noon every day for years. But other than that, pretty healthy.
Man. You know, I'll tell you what, folks, the stories John Moore could tell, the stories I could tell, and just from that time period, and a lot of people don't appreciate the time period that we're talking. You know, we, and I don't know about you, but I'll tell you what, several times, especially in smaller towns in upstate New York, I'm talking about upstate, like Lake Placid, Lake George, and places around there. If they didn't know you up there, okay, you would have the sheriff up there, I mean, draw down, you know, knock on your window. And if you didn't get to the front or you didn't answer, all of a sudden you're looking at the business end of a you know.
Well, my procedure was I'd go to the chief of the police department or the sheriff's department first before the surveillance. Give them my vehicle description, license plate, let them do a photocopy of my driver's license, and tell them why I wasn't there and how long I'd be there.
I did, you know, but here's the thing, John. I did the same thing. And I even had a form created where I filled it out before I did the surveillance.
Yeah, I had a form too.
Yeah and I published a very short-lived surveillance manual that had that form in it for people. But anyway, but you know, every single time in those rural communities, there was a sheriff, and then there was oftentimes the town police department. So I would go to one and the other would respond, especially if a neighbor and everyone, for the love of Pete, everyone's related to everyone else up there.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
It's like, you know, cousin Jimmy called me, you know, okay. Oh man. It was just, it was crazy. But, and that's, by the way, John, that's where I was testifying in court and, but you know, the pretext you use about, you know, being a nature person and
right. So, wildlife photographer.
No. Exactly. So I had this, I had in one of these small towns, I had everything printed up, everything done. I was a magazine, freelance editor for a magazine.
And there we go.
You know, and man, I had, so the target of the investigation, happened, long story short, I ended up talking to the target of the investigation, and the target admitted, like, just so much off the cuff. We were having coffee.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
And of course I had, you know, at that time and, you know, I just put those away, but I was showing people, did I show you folks the pen and pencil set? It was like a pen that had a pinhole camera in it. Anyway, right. I was wearing that. And, of course, I had like a VCR strapped to the back of my, it wasn't a VCR, obviously, but it was a small box that recorded it. It was analog back then, not digital. Anyway, so I recorded like all of his, I mean, stupid admissions to crimes. I mean, now even if my persona was accurate. Why would you do that? But nonetheless, they're not too smart.
He was bragging with what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, about 3 months later, it came time to go into court after, you know, so charges were filed and all this stuff. And, you know, so now comes the actual hearing, the actual hearing, the trial. And the judge up there, again, small town. I'm not going to name the town or the judge. I will say the judge is deceased now because he was old back then, but he's dead now.
Right.
And so I was on the stand. Got called up by the prosecutor. I'm on the stand. I'm telling, you know, they went through the entire introductory process, qualifications and all this.
Right,
and
right, right.
Done, right? So then the prosecutor said, okay, Mr. Hagman, tell me exactly how you were able to obtain this information that we're about to see. Cause there was a small TV. I actually had to bring the TV. It was my TV with the old TVs with the VCR tape thing. And,
yeah.
Okay. So it was my TV. Yeah, the courthouse didn't have one. So anyway, so I started explaining that, you know, I was under a pretext, which by the way is allowed by New York State criminal statute and law, but, and the judge, out of nowhere, after I said I posed as this, judge said, wait a minute. And I as God is my witness, this is true. Wait a minute. Stop. And I looked at the judge and the prosecutor's looking at him and like everyone's looking at him like, what? And the judge says, you did what? Explain that to me. You did what? I said, well, Your Honor, I posed as a reporter. You lied. Everyone. Okay. So then the prosecutor's saying, Your Honor. Everyone was like going apeshit nuts. Okay. In this courtroom, there's like, I don't know, maybe 9 people, including the bailiff and the, so they're going nuts. And he said, get the hell out of my courtroom. I don't like liars. I'm not going to take testimony or allow testimony to be given or to be given by liars. Mm-hmm. You're a liar. Get out of my courtroom. I'm like, this can't be happening because it's never. And I swear this happened. And it was written up in one legal journal. Okay.
Really?
Yeah. So I got off the stand and again, now this time you get the prosecutor yelling, you got the defense attorney yelling, you got the target. He's kind of having a field day over all this.
I bet.
The stenographer, she has no idea what the hell to do. What
court reporter,
type. Yeah, right. Court reporter. And the bailiff is like, what? Well, you know, it's a big bull on night court, right? Like, you know. So anyway, and you know, that's back when I was younger and a little bit more snarky than I am today. And the judge said something to me, and I don't know exactly what it is, what he said, but he really pissed me off. And I picked up that television and I threw it at the bench.
Oh, no. God,
oh, yeah. At the judge.
Oh no!
But see, and again, I swear this is 100% true. But it was plugged in, and the cord was kind of around the stand. You know those old school stands,
right?
Okay, so it didn't reach the bench; it just hit the floor. Nonetheless, it was like, you know, it was headed for the judge, and everything got quiet.
I bet. Oh. Was there a jury?
No jury. It was bench trial. No jury.
Bench trial. Got it.
And I took the advantage of that silence to pick up the television and get the hell out of there. Okay. And on my way out, seriously, I'm not lying. On my way out, the prosecutor says, you better get out of the county. Get out of the county.
Oh,
no, and you know what? Afterwards, of course, there was a mistrial, and afterwards, I had the New York the Bar Association contact me, or there's an association that presides over. They want to know if I wanted to file a complaint against the judge.
Right,
I said,
right.
No. Just, I mean, the guy. No, I don't do that. Guys don't do that shit. Unless the judge, you know, tossed me in jail, then it'd be a different story. But so there's a story, and people have heard that, and true story. And oh well. So John beat that.
Okay, I'll beat it.
There we go. Okay. All right, he's all in now.
First degree murder. Our client was charged with murdering his best friend with a knife at a bar. There was I don't recall what the, probably over a woman, but I don't recall what it was. But our guy did, in fact, use a knife, and the his best friend did die from the knife wound. But the dead guy was an expert martial arts guy, and our guy claimed he had a volleyball-sized bruise on his thigh from being kicked from the deceased, and there was a photograph of it.
All right.
All through discovery, he had our client initially had a public defender, and he got the money to hire us. And he says that photograph exists, and we couldn't get it. Couldn't find it. So I actually got one that'll top that. But the jury's picked.
I want you to tell both of them. Go ahead.
Okay, the jury's picked. I knew the prosecutor pretty well because he was from our county, and we were in an adjoining county, change of venue. And anyway, based on our client's statement that he said that photograph exists, I called the public defender again, and they looked at their file again that they'd looked before, and they found the photograph. The investigator for the public defender delivers it to the courthouse. I take delivery of the photograph, and I walk into the courtroom with the photograph that we're supposed to reveal all our evidence before the trial started, obviously.
Yeah, they get a little bit testy when you don't. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, and so I handed it to Mr. Shaw, and Mr. Shaw presented it to the judge, and the prosecutor was red as a beet. He was so angry that we brought this exculpatory evidence to the trial.
Are you telling me you legitimately could not? I mean, are you telling me that was the first opportunity you had to present that?
That's right. That's right. Because the public defender kept saying they didn't have it. Well, apparently it stuck it somewhere in that file that they couldn't find it. Well, here's a follow up on that. We had our client was a healthy black male, looked like he could be a professional linebacker for a football team, charged with beating his girlfriend this is in Mount Vernon, Illinois, a small town in southern Illinois, beating her, and she died on a busy street at high noon. Well, he did beat her, and she did die. So I got the toxicology report, the autopsy, and she had cocaine in her bloodstream. And so I called up a toxicologist I knew who worked for the St. Louis School of Pharmacy. And I said, Terry, what do these numbers mean? His first question was, how long after death was the blood drawn? I said, 12 hours. He says, here's the deal, John. Every 90 minutes, you have half the cocaine you did 90 minutes before. 12 hours later, she still had enough cocaine in her system to kill a horse.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
it gets better. It gets better. So, as most murder cases go, our trial preparation lasted a year, which is pretty typical. And through discovery and all the things that went on before the trial, the prosecutor felt that our defense was going to be the wild woman defense, that this woman was acting irrationally, and our client was attempting to subdue her because she was acting as a wild woman. That's what he believed. After the jury
wild
was
picked, woman. Now, is that a thing? Wild woman defense?
Well, it was that time.
Oh, my.
Okay. The trial starts. The jury's picked. And after the jury is picked, the prosecutor figures out what our real defense is that the woman died of a cocaine overdose. This is where it gets better. He stopped the trial and filed a brand new charge after the jury was picked that our client had forcibly injected cocaine to this woman and killed her.
Oh, come on.
You can't do that.
Oh, my. Is this stop?
You can't do that, but he did it anyway.
Yeah, well, no shit, you can't do that.
But we lost the trial, level one on appeal, and our guy is free, as he should be, because he didn't kill his girlfriend. She killed herself.
Yeah, but was Fannie Willis the prosecutor or what? I mean,
Mr. Shaw and I joked between ourselves if the prosecutor and the judge went to high school together, because you can't do that. In any of the 50 states, you can't do that. File a new charge after the jury's been picked.
Well, no kidding. That is,
the proper thing would have been for the judge to declare a mistrial and call it to an end.
100%.
But, you know, he didn't do that, obviously.
So okay, and to folks, so the second story you got to tell us, but that is amazing. So, you know, that movie Injustice for All, which I used to have the intro music for Injustice for All,
right?
Play as the music there, or that sound piece as our intro, where Al Pacino's there saying, you're not gonna get that man today, I'm gonna get him anyway. To appreciate what John is saying and what we've been saying here, that's the environment.
I got a bizarre story for you.
That wasn't bizarre. Go ahead, continue.
Well, okay. Federal. Our client was a middle-aged black businessman who ran the biggest, nicest adult entertainment place in Manhattan, Illinois, which had six or eight of those kind of places. And the feds being the FBI, the DEA, and the IRS all decided, well, we'll go after this guy because he's got the biggest and nicest adult entertainment place in this town in Southern Illinois. So they raid the place. They arrest him. They confiscate thousands of pages of records, which I had to inventory all those, by the way.
I would have paid.
They thought, well, here's what they thought. They thought they'd find a beat up girls high on drugs. They didn't. The girls all loved them. They'd find buckets full of cash, buckets full of drugs. They didn't find either of that. What they found was the girls were all happy and healthy and loved them. They found no drugs. They found that our guy had the best accounting firm in the area to do all his accounting properly to the penny. All taxes paid.
Oh.
Well, it gets better. They had a 20 by 20 foot room with thousands of documents. My job was to inventory those, which is kind of a side note. But here's a legal theory. Now,
folks, that's
here's
more
the legal
than a
theory.
Note.
This is where the real good part comes in. This right. is, I think, the fall of 1999. The same federal government that was prosecuting him for, I'll get to the exact charges in a moment. The what was the name of that place in Las Vegas? The famous prostitution business in Los Angeles. Chicken Ranch. Yeah, they were running it. It had been foreclosed on in a bankruptcy, and the federal government was running a house of prostitution in Las Vegas. Now, here's the legal theory that they prosecuted this guy. The customers were using an ATM. So a guy from St. Louis went over there, and he got cash out of the ATM. So the legal theory was the cash crossed a state line. That made it illegal.
That's a novel theory, isn't it?
Nothing else. They had nothing else to prosecute this guy on other than the cash came out of the ATM, came across a state line illegally. That was it.
You got to squint for that one.
We were in trial for 2 months in federal court.
Okay.
2 months. We watched. It was the longest jury trial of Mr. Shaw's career, the longest trial I was ever in. And it was a travesty, an absolute travesty.
Holy crap. Okay, so
how bizarre is that? The federal government who's prosecuting for prostitution is running a house of prostitution.
Well, you know, that speaks to, John, God bless you, man. That speaks to everything that's happening today. But How do you stretch that? Is it 2 months? I mean,
well, 1,000. You know, I did all trial preparation. The government had more than 1,000 individual exhibits in a very large three-ring binder.
I don't think I've ever seen or heard
and
of
they had
1,000 exhibits.
All the confiscated records were stacked up for the jury to see them. They were good to complete detailed business records, but they made it look like they were something special, all stacked up in the courtroom for the jury to see.
Oh, yeah. Very performative. And that's the thing, too, John. And I think people realize that a lot of the courtroom stuff is performative. And,
well, they go to schools to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
To make it look as just as dandy as they can make it look.
And part of that, too, and I'll just say this, because the behavioral analysis, behavioral profiling, behavioral analysis as a certified forensic discipline is often used in high stakes trials. And so if somebody, for example, is certified in behavioral analysis, behavioral profiling, they'll sit with the prosecution or defense, and they will say, okay, that person, you know, for example, that person there doesn't, you know, depending on if you're for the prosecution, that person doesn't like cops, you know, just judging by the body language. And so it's really, folks, it's a science and art. And a lot of it's performative.
The jury selection in Mount Vernon, we had a former deputy sheriff who knew everybody on our team to help with jury selection. And by the way, he's the same guy that got the cash when he left Vietnam.
Oh, okay. No, jeez, man. Really?
Yeah. Man. Yeah, jury selection is an art, and a lot of thought goes in. I've been part of that for I don't know how many times, many times.
Yeah, it's it really is. And, you know, John, and we look at our legal system today, the way it is right now, it's not really a justice system, it's a legal system, because I don't think you don't go to court. Today, you don't go to court for justice. You're not going to find it there.
A jury is 12 people who decide who's got the best lawyer.
That's 100%, 100%, yep. Or, jury nullification as a thing right now, tainting juries, just everything that's going on right now, and especially with the grand juries, the runaway grand juries. So a runaway grand jury is, you know, going after somebody, not just for those crimes, but let's find some more stuff. And then you've got these, there's a term for them, and I forget, the other type of grand jury where they kind of just say, you know, you could show us that he's, you know, killed somebody on video, and we ain't gonna indict him.
Really?
Ain't gonna happen. Oh yeah. So yeah, there's two things. So that's what right now is taking place. I had a conversation, maybe it was a while back now, but with a assistant U.S. attorney. Former U.S. attorney. And we had a conversation about the system now versus how it was. And I know I have that name of the other type of folks in the chat. You guys are smart. Maybe there's an attorney in there. You got your runaway grand jury, and then there's another grand jury where they just refuse to, again, in spite of evidence, they say, screw it, we ain't indicting you. I might have that wrong. Maybe not. So if you know the name of that, let me know. But yeah. And Don, John, I thought of you too during this. Somebody just brought up in the chat about Don, or put Don Lemon in there. What's your take as an investigator on the city's church invasion, shall we say, attack?
Well, there's a federal statute. It's called the SAFE Act.
Yeah.
Which makes it a crime, yes, to interrupt a religious ceremony, procedure of some kind. Don Lemon's defense, I think, falls apart when the video shows him being an active participant, not somebody observing and reporting his observations, but he was an active participant handing out coffee and donuts to the protesters and being part of the disruption, not a not a dispassionate, separate reporter. He was part of it, best I can tell.
You know, the evidence showed, in my view, the self-published evidence by Lemon and that group show him participating in the planning,
right,
the execution.
Exactly.
You know, and for him to claim exemption under the First Amendment, as you said, the FACE Act, I think you said say it's the FACE Act.
Right.
So anyway, or unless I'm mistaken, but
it is the FACE Act. Yes.
Okay, because that covers not just churches and religious places of worship, but it also covers the abortion mills.
The second paragraph specifically goes to religious services. The first paragraph deals with the abortion services.
Correct. Yeah. It's so. With what I found, again, my online surveillance, with what I found is the attacks are going to increase. So, unless something does happen, and and they are polluting the jury pool out there right now. And that's one of the other things I didn't mention, but I will now, is they are saying, get on juries. To nullify the any prosecution against these people. So, just saying, man.
Well, if it's a federal jury, they'll pick the jury from the entire state, not just Minneapolis. And once you're 10 miles away from Minneapolis, people will think and act normal.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But you know, what? I'm okay. I just want to not jury on nullification. So there's a runaway grand jury, and then there's a biased or captive. That's the word, captive grand jury. And my apologies. The runaway grand jury, I misrepresented this a bit for the purists, the lawyers out there. A runaway grand jury acts independently of the prosecutor. They'll investigate on their own. They'll issue subpoenas on their own, believe it or not, or produce reports against the prosecutor's wishes. The prosecutor's saying, no. And then they're saying, no, we're going to do it. And then the captive grand jury is one that, and again, forgive me on the mischaracterization here, they will rubber stamp the prosecutor's agenda regardless of what the evidence shows. So anyway.
Most of them are captive, the majority of them.
Correct. Yeah, correct. So, okay. Now that I've kind of directed the whole conversation or the whole episode, and folks, by the way, for more sensible and sane and informative conversation, tune into the John Moore Show. Okay. Tune into John Moore's radio show. Go to thelibertyman.com and folks, or John, tell people time and plug
okay.
Your
well,
show.
My show is Monday through Friday, 7 to 10 a.m. Central, 8 to 11 Eastern. We have the live broadcast is at time 7 to 10 Central, Monday through Friday. We have 8 platforms where we have video archives, Rumble and use and so forth, plus an additional hour every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. Central, a video podcast that's live on YouTube and Rumble, that people can watch that as well. And I have a different guest there each week for that.
But that's one of the best, to me, that's one of the best things you've done. I'm just saying, as a fan of yours, a follower of yours, listener and viewer, that's one of the best things you've done.
Well, my guest tomorrow on the podcast will be Stephen Starr. He wrote a book on the effects of EMP, and he's been in contact with the U.S. Congress to give testimony. And he's the real deal when it comes to understanding what happens with EMP.
Man, that EMPs concern me a lot. Not for myself. And ladies and gentlemen, think about this. It's the other guy you have to worry about, or the person who can't live without internet cable, can't live without a microwave, can't live without power. Okay, those people are going to be a problem, but.
What we don't know is, did the U.S. forces use a small EMP device in Venezuela?
You've heard the stories coming out of there.
It's very likely they did, from what I've seen.
And man, what the hell kind of, but what, because the stories I heard about what happened on the ground in Venezuela during the Maduro extraction, or
they built the military built a full-size mock-up of the presidential palace, and they practiced and practiced and practiced. The defenders of Maduro didn't have a chance.
No, not even close. But as you mentioned, there was a certain weaponry, and even President Trump made kind of a remark about it. But man, it almost sounded like some of these people were turned to dust. Okay, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, all the advanced weaponry that's remained secret, and as well it should.
Blah. Yeah, somebody in the chat wrote discombobulator.
Well, that was Delta Force, and back in 1979, I was trying to figure out how to join Delta Force, but the name itself was secret. The Army didn't even admit they existed back in 1979, 1980. But I tried hard, probably saved my life not getting involved with them, but I had more testosterone than I did sense at the time, I guess.
As we all, however, I don't have a problem with testosterone right now, but I can tell you I had more then than I do now.
Obviously. John,
right. Yeah, obviously. Right. Yeah, it's just one of those things.
However, run all day, run all night.
But I still do a line of tea right off the back of a DeLorean. So anyway, I'm kidding. Strike that comment. Strike it. All right. Ever the comedian. So, John, in the remaining time we have, I don't know, 10 minutes or whatever, what is it's to you? You talk about whatever you want to talk about, even if you want to give us a recipe, go ahead.
Well, okay. I have hope that the economy will become a golden economy by July. I have hope that what President Trump is doing will turn around the communists and the Muslims, what they want to do. And we have something all our listeners can do is make sure that their conservative Christian friends, neighbors, coworkers, relatives are all registered to vote. We have midterms coming up. Traditionally, the presidents lose the House and or the Senate. After they've been elected to the opposite party, we can't have that because that'll shut down what President Trump wants to do the next 2 years following the midterms beginning in January of 2027. He'll be crippled if we lose the midterms. We need to win the House and the Senate by a good majority to make President Trump's efforts move forward, Bobby Kennedy's efforts move forward, have all the executive orders become law instead of executive orders, which can be reversed very easily, and then set the stage for J.D. Vance or a similar guy to take over the reins when President Trump's term of office is finished. This is not over. It'll take at least 8 more years after President Trump is done to turn around what the communists and Muslims and liberal Democrats have done for decades.
Agreed. Yeah.
So focus on that. I'm the Republican committeeman for my township. We raise money to help Republicans that need it for their races. Most of the 3,300 counties in the United States have a Republican Central Committee. Many of these Central Committees have vacancies because people are too busy with their careers, their family, their church, and watching pro sports to even take the time to join their local committee. Join your local Republican committee. Get active. Get people registered to vote. It's disappointing how many conservative Christians, how many gun owners haven't even bothered to register to vote. And we still got the numbers, and we can make use of those numbers. If people need a ride to the polls, give them a ride. If they need a ride to get registered to vote, give them a ride. Whatever it takes, we need to keep winning these elections to save our republic.
Did you think on that topic, the SAVE Act is now, I guess, was somewhat resurrected? You said, look, we need that to pass same-day vote. I mean, the... to make sure that the
Dominion voting machines were based out of Venezuela.
Correct, yes.
And we need to eliminate the Venezuelan Dominion voting machines. We need to eliminate mail-in ballots. We need to make sure people are really Americans, showing ID that they're Americans to vote. All those things need to happen, because if not, we're done.
That's right. I 100% agree. And anyone who does not vote, if the SAVE Act does go for full vote, if they don't vote for it, then those people are enemies of the Republic, in my
Absolutely.
View.
You know, absolutely.
And yeah, we can't look. The stuff about 2020 coming out, John, is what we expected, but it's criminal. It's actually traitorous, and we
it
need
is.
To, you know, yeah,
it is.
It's really crazy, but my goodness. Yeah.
Well, I get up in less than 6 hours to do my radio show. So
I know.
I'm going to call tonight here.
I will release you without a problem.
Thank you, sir.
And I just want to say thank you so much for really classing the place.
It's been too long. Good to talk to you, Doug.
It's great to talk with you and folks that really support John.
I got more stories, by the way.
And you know, we're going to tell those stories.
Okay. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, brother. Thank you,
Doug. Have a good evening.
Right. Folks, make sure you tune into John's radio show. And I'll tell you what, again, he's all, the guy's all business and very professional. Me, you know, hey, look, I just don't care. All right. At this point anymore. Last question of the day. I did not catch this. Maybe you listening and watching, whether it's on X now or Rumble. Let me ask you guys a question. Because I didn't watch it. Dan Bongino came back today. Thoughts? I guess he was a little bit peeved at some of the criticism. Hey, I don't know. You know, before Dan Bongino went into that office, I was even Eric the Tech. I mean, we talked, and Eric the Tech, myself, and Randy Taylor, and I talked, and other people. And hey, man, go for it. Go with God. Righteously do your job. I mean, do it. And now he's been there, done that. Apparently has not just a t-shirt, but a whole line of suits. Maybe I don't know, but thoughts? Did he do a good job? I don't know. So that crossed my mind. I will eventually look at today's program, his program, but I'm just curious what people think, because here's my thought. All right. I don't need friends. I don't need praise. I don't need recognition. I don't need anything. Okay. Because as my wife says, you know what? You're just a grouchy old SOB. Okay. I say what I think to everyone, especially to my wife's, like, God bless that woman, because she puts up with me. Because if I'm in the store, all right, and I see some, you know, whacked out blue haired punk with a nose ring and a tattoo between the, you know, piercings everywhere, right? And they say or do something, I have got no problem speaking my mind in the middle of wherever we're at. Not a problem. Whereas before, you know, in my younger days, I would have